So today we'll continue investigating this case number 79 in the Book of Serenity. Wansang's introduction. The Bodhisattva appearing as a maiden on the banks of golden sand was a special spirit. Stuffing pastries in a crystal jar, who would dare to roll it? Without going into the frightening waves, it's hard to find a suitable fish. How about one expression of walking relaxed with big strides? And the case. Changsha had a monk ask Master Wei, how was it before you saw Nanchuan? Hui remained silent. The monk said, how about after seeing him? Hui said, nothing special. The monk returned and related this to Changsha. Changsha said, the man sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though he's gained entry, this is not yet the real. Atop the 100-foot pole, he should step forward. The universe in all directions is the whole body. The monk said, atop the 100-foot pole, how can you step forward? Changsha said, the mountains of Lang, the rivers of Li. The monk said, I don't understand. Changsha said, the whole land is under the imperial sway. And Hongjie's verse, the jade man's dream is shattered. One call from the rooster, looking around on life, all colors are equal. Wind and thunder with news of events roust out the hibernating insects. Peach trees, wordless, naturally make a path. When the time and season comes, laboring at the plow, who fears the spring rose knee-deep mud? So today I want to comment on a piece of Wansang's commentary. Wansang, who collected these cases in the Book of Serenity and who included Hongjie's beautiful verses in this collection, has a commentary on both the case and on the verse. And I just want to read you a little bit of the commentary on the case itself. Changsha said in verse, the man sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though he's gained entry, this is not yet the real. This, and Yanto's saying to Shui Feng that Deshan didn't know the last word, are troubled about the same thing. I always tell people that it's much like someone having taken their grandparents' house and business and their relatives themselves and sold them off on the same ticket, then put it in a crystal jar which you keep with you wherever you are, guarding it like your eyeballs. Don't let me see. I'd surely pick it up and smash it, making your hands free. Folks joyfully alive with no taboos. So I really like this little section of the commentary. It's a very long commentary. And there's so much that we could look into here. But I was particularly touched personally and I would say in a revelatory way by Wang Song's comment about Deshan not knowing the last word of Zen, because this comes from another koan, one of my very favorites, and many of you know it. The short version of it is that Deshan, when he was an old man, he had been a very feisty young man, and when he was an old man, he came down to a meal, and the meal wasn't ready. And in some versions of this koan, it says that the meal was late. And I don't know if you know what happens to the tenzo when the meal is late. We haven't had to deal with it yet, but it's a big deal. And the cook, the tenzo, Shui Feng, yelled at him, yelled at the Zen master. This happens sometimes. And said, what are you doing? the bell hasn't rung, and we're not ready. And Deshan just simply bowed and went back to his room. And later, the head monk talked to the Tenso, be a little bit like Diane talking to Justin. "What is going on?" the Tenso said. "What's wrong with our teacher?" And the head monk said, "Great as he is, Deshan still doesn't know the last word of Zen." Now, in this koan that we're dealing with, the conventional understanding, which we talked about yesterday, all three of us, is that the being on top of the pole, being stuck on top of the pole, thinking that everything is the same, being stuck in emptiness. We have this revelation after living in the world of form for all our lives, and suddenly we see, oh my gosh, everywhere I look, the Dharma light is shining, or something like that. Maybe not so pretty, but we see, we begin to see in little bits and sometimes in big, big bits. Sometimes it's an opening of the heart that's so profound that all this time we've been working really hard to maintain a separate self, and that's the cause of so much of our suffering. And in this trying to maintain a separate self, the moment that we see through that delusion, we cling to that. We cling like that little person Josh talked about yesterday, clinging to the little tiny seat, the little top of the pole, the 100-foot pole, just clinging desperately to this wonderful experience of everything dropping away. And the conventional understanding is that Changsha was criticizing the hermit Hui here by saying he was that man clinging to the pole, and that he should step off the pole and step into the world where form and emptiness are no longer opposites, where everything becomes our life, our vividly lived life. This vividly lived life is also pointed to in Hongzhi's verse, where he talks about looking around on life, all colors are equal. Wind and thunder, news of events. You have to remember that these pieces were written in the 11th and 12th century in China, when things were just as rocky and difficult as they are now politically. Things were happening, wars, starvation. News of events is code for this world of suffering. Wind and thunder, news of events. Roust out the hibernating insects. Everything is crazed, and peach trees, wordless, naturally make a path. The whole world is alive with meaning, but our job is not to try to interpret this, but to continue walking on the path that is demonstrated to us by peach trees, by wind and thunder, and the news of events. Everything that arises is it. So from this point of view, if everything that's arising is it, how could Yanto, the head monk in Deshan's monastery, be criticizing his master? How could not knowing the last word of Zen be a criticism? How could Changsha criticize monk Hui by saying he needs to step off the top of a 100-foot pole, being on the pole, stepping off the pole? These are conventional understandings of emptiness and form. But really, every moment on the pole is it. And every moment stepping forward is it. And the peach trees are trying to explain that to us, but they don't have a language that we can understand. But they light our path. They show us the way. And Wang Song himself describes this in this kind of convoluted way. He refers to the story about Deshan. Yanto saying to Zhui Feng that he didn't know the last word of Zen, and he says, these people who hold these things up as problems are troubled about the same thing. And then there's that interesting selling your grandparents' house and business and your relatives themselves, selling your relatives, selling them off on the same ticket and putting them in a crystal jar. No pastries in this jar. Full of your old relatives. It's sort of like a metaphor for how we look back at the conga line of past selves, as Josh was discussing yesterday. All these things smashed in that jar, and we hold on to it for dear life. We keep it with us wherever we are, guarding it like our own eyeballs. Yeah, that's what it feels like sometimes. My history, let me tell you, I had a hard time. Here's the jar, and look, holding it tight, falling in love with it, getting married to it, having babies with it. This is what Hongjer calls becoming the partner of every particle of dust. Enough. How about being free of this? How about feeling the sides of that jar, the actual holding of the hands against the glass, and knowing that this is it? Wang Song would come along and smash the jar, but that's even extra. Make your hands free, he says. Let folks be joyfully alive with no taboos. When I considered this over the last couple of days, and I've spoken to a couple of you about it in Doksan, would we, any of us, really want to know the last word of Zen? Wow! I've met people who think they know the last word of Zen. It's an oppressive thing. I'm done. Yep. Oh, greed, anger, ignorance. Yep, done. I've stepped off that pole a long time ago. My life is fully integrated. Oh, war, pestilence, suffering, oppression? No problem. I know the last word of Zen. I really believe that in our path of Boundless Way Zen, we invite a kind of being present with things as they are that is so radical, so profound, that there is no last word of Zen. There's no place where we settle and go, yep, that's the way the world is, uh-huh, no more worries. But we feel fully the great suffering that surrounds us. We feel it so much that whether we're clinging to a pole or whether we've stepped off, whether we're holding tightly to the crystal jar or we've smashed it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that we continue walking this path that is demonstrated to us by the peach trees. And we'll continue with Josh and David's comments.
Not knowing the last word of Zen, not knowing is most intimate, not knowing. So glad I know that's not the last word. Hongjer's verse, the jade man's dream is shattered at one call from the rooster. Looking around on life, all colors are equal. The jade man's dream is shattered, the dream of being jade, the dream of being man, the dream of being separate, shattered by just this, the coughing call of the rooster. looking around on life, all colors are equal. When I was a kid, I always heard people talking about favorite colors. And I identified that clearly there was a deficit in me because I didn't actually have a favorite color. And so I decided green was my favorite color. And this lasted for quite some time, basically up until my Zen monastic days, when black became my favorite color. Because, you know, Zen. If it came in black, I got it in black. Black. And then I rockily left my period of Zen monastic exploration with much ambivalence towards Zen. And so I decided that bright orange was my favorite color. Because fuck Zen! For the last 11 years, I've been with my partner, who is deeply committed to blue. Everything in blue. And I love her so much that I have now developed a fondness and a preference for blue. Looking around on life, though, all colors are equal. Green, black, orange, blue, joy, grief, preference, aversion. One is not a bad version of the other. Spaciousness is spaciousness. Contraction is contraction. Black is black and blue is blue. Regarding the end of this koan, atop 100-foot pole, how can you step forward? Changsha said, the mountains of Long, the rivers of Li. And I want to hold up another way of hearing this. So we so imagine that we either need to stay atop the pole or step off the pole. But what if we hear this as, so right there, while you're atop the pole, also because the whole universe is your body, the mountains of Long, the rivers of Li have already stepped forward off the pole. No doing required from you. What if the way is like that? What if it's not you who steps off the pole?
So if it's not you, who is it? Who is the one who decided to come? Who is the one who is hearing these words? Of course, you say, well, I am. But who is this mysterious someone? Who you are, these precious stories, and indeed, I want to say our stories of our life, of our sorrows, of our triumphs, are such a blessing. knee-deep in the mud. Our hands on the plow of our karma. How precious to be born into this world of 10,000 joys and sorrows. But who is it that is breathing your breath? Who is it who's keeping track of how you're doing? Well, you're doing pretty well. Oh boy, bad period. Oh no, I'm doing okay. The constant checking. Who is the one who checks? Who is the one who sits? Who is walking? The world is not something out there. We are not something in here. So this precious opportunity to inquire, to do nothing, to abandon all strategies and plans, to abandon all hope. To settle in to this effortlessly functioning life. To be held and sustained. By everything that arises. And by everything that passes away. There is no other life. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably. And we'll engage in our speaking and listening, our Dharma dialogue. Here's Bob and Cindy.
Thank you all three. There's just so much that you guys have put out there that I think that what's coming out of your talks and what's coming out of this koan is about a way of encountering the world. And just putting it like that is wrong. because it implies two. I did puzzle a little bit, like Willie yesterday, about the motivation of the figures in the koan. But then I decided that it's trying to communicate something about this encounter. I don't think that... I mean, what matters in the story is the fact that the monk was sent. It doesn't really matter why. He was sent and he had an encounter. And the first time he gets no answer, the second time he gets the answer, nothing special. And his business is not to try and puzzle that out or to speculate about the motivation of the teachers, but just to encounter that and its effect on his being. For some reason, this put me in mind of growing up in my family, where whenever anything happened, it was always a question of, who is to blame? That's what people wanted to know. And you know, it's a little like the story of the arrow that pierces the man and he wants to know who shot it. It's futile. What matters is that something happened. And so I hear this in the koan that, and its message for me is to kind of fall back upon that very fundamental level of encounter rather than and come out of my speculation, my all of the stuff that goes on. And I think it's also developed in the commentary. And just one comment on one part of it, the dream of the jade man is shattered. And Josh said, his dream of being jade, his dream of being man or woman. That gives me a little chill, you know, that's the ultimate, the ultimate stepping back. But at any rate, that's what I feel coming out of it, and this is my opportunity to actualize it. So thank you.
Thank you.
And letting even that be shattered. Letting even our stories of stories be shattered too.
You know, this reminds me, your comments remind me of a story that Milton Erickson, the psychiatrist, used to tell, that every schizophrenic on every back ward can tell you exactly why he's the way he is. And they're still there. You know, that this self-explanation, it leads nowhere. And that this practice of Zen is not about figuring things out. You're really right on there, Pierce. And you have to have had a life of trying to figure things out to see thoroughly how useless that is, right? And I think we're all trained so well to do that, to analyze, that we have to have that shattering experience and see how much we've been clinging to wanting to be jade. Thank you.
Thank you. So it
was
Bob. Well, I was really struck by the image of the relatives in the jar. And first I spent a lot of time imagining some of my relatives in the jar, thinking what that would be like. But I heard another thing in it, which was, yeah, just...
Now we all did.
doing the Marcel Marceau thing with the glass. Right, you know, right. But the other thing I heard was a plea from the ancestors, don't put us in a jar that, you know, because they're our relatives, right?
Right?
They
right.
are.
Yes.
And that, wow. you know, that I, my mind wants to say, okay, the pole means this, and stepping off the pole means that, and this is who was criticizing, and my mind wants that kind of certainty, and they're saying, we were living, breathing, and these stories are ever changing, fluid, and I realized this morning, in one period, I was the guy who didn't know, and I was the guy who was criticizing, and I was the guy who got sent somewhere and didn't know where he was. And so it seemed to me this call from our ancestors saying, please don't stick us in a jar, we're alive, and this is so alive.
Thank you.
And if you do stick us in the jar, by all means, roll that jar down the hill.
Or put some sweets in for us.
Yes, some pastries for the kids. Oh, now I get it. Thank you.
Cindy and then Mike.
Oh. About it.
Oh, I didn't say something.
Oh, okay. Cindy, say something.
The image of the peace showing us the way, it's just kind of immersed me in that vivid smell of fallen peaches on the tree or off the tree and maybe some yellow jackets buzzing around or something too.
Yeah.
And that edgy moment somehow speaks to me. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The big trees we have over on the right side of the property with all the big trunks and sort of round leaves, they're called katsura trees. And in the fall, the bark lets off this vaguely sweet, almost cinnamon-like scent. So thinking of the smell of the peach trees, we have the smell of the katsura trees to lead us as we walk outside.
Which we didn't plant, by the way. Our ancestors planted. You know, people who came a long time before planted those trees. They didn't know there was going to be a Zen temple on this property. Or maybe they did.
Mike and then Derek.
Thank you. Josh. I hear you talk about how the conventional idea is that, you know, being stuck with a pole and being stuck in the idea, you know, get it, you feel it, you get it. For me, maybe, obviously, I'm just stuffed into the story, but being stuck on the pole is just being certain that I don't get it.
Yeah, all right.
Totally, yeah, I'm just stuck. And I've taken up indoor rock climbing recently, and when I go, I usually go with a friend, and when I have to come down, I have that friend is belaying me down, and they let me down gently, but sometimes I have to go alone, and they have these auto belays, these machines, and when you're up at the top of the wall and you let go, there's a moment where you feel like you're totally, there's nothing going to catch you, the machine is, you know, it has that good, and that was the image that came to me when you said something off. No matter how certain you are whether you got it right or got it wrong, it's scary as hell.
Yeah.
And often you fall on your butt because it's just awkward.
Yeah. Life, you mean.
Often you fall on your butt because it's awkward.
Yeah. Great. Well said, Mike.
Well said.
Beautiful.
Derek?
Yeah, I have a hard time abandoning hope. You know, I mean, like, I only abandon it like when I'm forced to. and then it's like it's all over. You know, it's just the end. And I think that's what Sesshin helps me do is abandon hope. Because when I'm on my own, you know, I get one win, and I'm often proving myself in one way or changing myself in another. But here, there's you just, this is it, this is all you've got.
But the reading yesterday talks about at the end of the iron wall, you know, at the end of the road, it's an iron wall. And all of this progress we make in our practice leads us to some place that's really, genuinely impossible. And we can't even kid ourselves that it's workable, right? And one of the odd things about Zen is we actually value this place. And I don't think, Derek, I don't think any of us go there until we have no option. I think it's what Melissa was saying to Pierce, you know. I'm going to think about it until I am absolutely certain that thinking about it is not going to be the way. And even if I have a sliver of hope, right,
there's, put it in the jar.
There's no hope. So, and going to what James was saying last night, the courage it takes. Because when it's really happening, it doesn't feel zen and cool.
Yeah.
You know, it is not a small matter here. But all of us know it is somewhere in us. We know this is the heart of it. And that if we stay there, the promise is the promise of life. The promise of being reborn, not through our own efforts or cleverness or our great insight, but because we are a part of everything. Yeah. Thank you.
Julie.
Just with the talk about the last words of Zen, just reminding me of the old story about the tourist in Maine who asks a local, "Have you lived here all your life?" The local says, "Not yet."
And however hard this period of Zazen, however much you're sure that this is the worst day of your life, know that it's only the worst day of your life so far. And the good news is that failure actually is an option. This is the liberation. Fail completely. Fail thoroughly. Fail wholeheartedly, even if wholeheartedly means all you can muster is half-assedly.
I've been thinking of the last word of Zen also, and I guess what started out to me sounding sort of like an admonishment sounds really encouraging, like it's okay to be human, you're going to continue with that, and stop expecting to be perfect. And so I really appreciate that sort of little sidetrack to the story.
Yeah. And you know, it's got that piece is really, really true, and I think we can all relate to it. And I also want to say that this path that we're on is unimaginably, what's the noun I want to put in here? Unimaginably vast. It's every opening we feel, oh great, every insight, oh, and it's always more. So it's not. It's always more, you know, like that those people in Maine. You know, if we think, great, I've achieved this, or we think, you know, well, I had that insight, that wasn't worth very much. If this is what Zen is, that's stupid. just to keep on going, and the mind that we are, that we have now, can't know the mind of the future. It just can't. So even when we're in the worst place, I mean, we could ask for a show of hands right now. How many of us have really been up Schitt's Creek? You know, how many
today?
Of us, just today, right? In our life, everybody would have raised their hand, and then it didn't last. It changed, and something came from it. What's that about? So this ongoing practice, this practice that never, never ends, no last word, never a last word, except I think this is the last word for today. So thank you, everybody.